The plan that we are voting on today will make a tremendous difference, not only in the budgets of the states, but in the lives of the American people. The public health, education of our children, the sanitation that is so important in defeating the virus, with the support of so many essential workers.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, as the House moves to pass a $3 trillion coronavirus economic relief bill, which includes money for state and local governments, as well as a second round of direct payments to Americans, despite a veto threat from President Donald Trump. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, May 15th, 2020. The House also making a change to its rules to allow proxy voting during the pandemic. A member not in Washington may authorize another member who is in Washington to vote for him or her on the House floor. President Trump unveils the team leading a federal effort called Operation Warp Speed to accelerate development of a coronavirus vaccine and be ready to distribute millions of doses when it is ready to go. The president said, "We're looking to get it by the end of the year if we can, maybe before." And New York joins the list of states starting to reopen, with parts of the state beginning phase one, even as Governor Andrew Cuomo extends the stay-at-home order for other regions until the end of the month. That and more coming up on Washington Today. And we begin on the U.S. House floor in Washington and the House Democratic bill. It's named by them the HEROES Act. More than $3 trillion in coronavirus economic relief. Speaker Nancy Pelosi noting that about a third will go to state, local, tribal, and territorial governments to shore up their budgets, keep essential public employees on the job, and keep those services coming to the American people.
Today, the House will consider the HEROES Act to honor those who on the front lines, our healthcare workers, our first responders, teachers, sanitation workers, food providers, transit workers, and other essential workers. Many of them have risked their lives to save lives, and now they may lose their jobs. For many of them, this is just what is happening right now as governors across the country are planning their budgets. As the coronavirus takes its vicious toll on the lives and livelihoods of the country, it has also taken a toll on the states to deliver services to the people. Governors are forced to either cut services or increase taxes or both. The Congress must honor its responsibility to the American people to lessen the blow of the coronavirus by making the same serious investment of the HEROES Act to our state, local, tribal, and territorial governments.
The bill that Speaker Nancy Pelosi and her party put forward also includes money for an extension of enhanced unemployment insurance benefits and increased food assistance, as well as a national testing strategy and another round of direct payments to Americans. More from the Speaker.
We can all agree that we must open the economy, for sure, as quickly as we can. But we must do so based on science and data. The key to opening this door is testing, tracing, treating, and social distancing. Overwhelmingly, the scientific community agrees. The HEROES Act has a strategic plan, something that has been lacking thus far. A strategic plan with a vision to end this plague, a strategic vision, a goal, a timetable, milestones, benchmarks put forth by the Energy and Commerce Committee. Mr. Pallone, thank you. And that is really important. You have to have a plan to succeed. As families are devastated by the loss of life, this legislation putting money in the pockets of the American people, which is also a stimulus for the economy, is essential. They're suffering so much in so many ways. We want to lessen the pain for them.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the House floor. The House Republican leader, the minority leader Kevin McCarthy, spoke expressing his opposition to this bill.
This 1,800-page, $3 trillion proposal isn't a serious attempt at making public policy. Mr. Speaker, I listened to your talk, what you had before your conference. I listened to what Speaker Pelosi told your conference to go big. Instead of going big, it seems you went crazy. This is a political messaging bill that has no chance of becoming law. That's not my opinion. That's opinion from your own members and from the media itself. And why do they have that opinion? Let's look at the flaws in this bill itself. Its central demands were written behind closed doors, predates the crisis, and are not targeted to the coronavirus. Changing election laws won't speed up the development of treatments or cures. That was your number one bill, H.R. 1. Do you remember back when you introduced that, the very first bill in Congress? Long before anyone ever heard of coronavirus. Bailing out mismanaged pensions won't keep cash-strapped Main Street afloat as Americans practice social distancing. Suspending the cap on SALT tax deductions for millionaires and billionaires won't reach the 36 million Americans who are now unemployed. You promised to do that in your campaign, not when the virus came forth. This bill has more references to cannabis industry in it than it does to jobs. Even though it is jobs, not dispensaries, that are going up in smoke. Millions of more dollars earmarked for the National Endowment for the Arts. That won't stop China from hacking our companies and universities who are working towards a vaccine.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on the House floor. The Washington Post reports the sweeping legislation also faces opposition within the House Democratic caucus, with some moderate lawmakers objecting to voting on a bill that they know will not become law. Some liberals, meanwhile, have complained that the package does not go far enough to aid the public in the midst of an unprecedented economic meltdown. One of the Democrats who wanted to see more aid was Pramila Jayapal. She spoke to reporters outside the U.S. Capitol.
I think it's an incredibly important vote. I, unfortunately, will be voting no on the bill. This was a difficult decision for me. There were a lot of things that are good in the bill. But at the end of the day, I think that for us as Democrats, we should be putting forward our plan of a couple of things, how we keep people from getting unemployed, how we stop mass unemployment, how do we keep paychecks in people's pockets. The second thing is how do we cover healthcare for everybody. And the third is how do we protect businesses from shuttering. And those three big things are critically important because what people want is stability. You know, I have people who, I mean, I'm glad we're expanding unemployment insurance and continuing that, but my deep belief is that we need to invest in our economy and that relationship between workers and their employers. This is a proposal that's been same idea from Republicans in the Senate as well. And so I think this bill, I can't go home to people and tell them that there's certainty that they're going to get money in their pockets. I do think the state and local government funding is really important. And I guess I wished that we were putting forward a bill that had state and local government funding, a paycheck guarantee or paycheck recovery, healthcare plan that ties reopening of states to CDC guidance and protection for businesses. And I just unfortunately don't think that this has that. So I hope we can work on it, make it better, and, you know, see where we go from there.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal with reporters outside the U.S. Capitol building. The Democratic-led House brought up the $3 trillion aid bill, even as the Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he does not want to take up another spending bill at this point, and his party is still, as he put it, assessing what we've done already, and President Trump issuing a veto threat, calling the bill dead on arrival. Here is Larry Kudlow, director of the National Economic Council, with reporters outside the White House.
Another $3 trillion package just seems off target to me. There are a lot of things in that package that were not bipartisan, that tried before and were rejected. But we just passed the $3 trillion one. Let's see how it does, really. All right. You know, we're in free fall for the second quarter. I've acknowledged that for many, many, many weeks. There are some signs, early glimmers, just tiny glimmers, that the huge jump in the decline in employment and the jump in unemployment, we may have seen the worst. It's still heartbreak. I'm just saying, let's wait. I would just add this, and many of you have heard me say this before, and I'll say it again. I don't believe we can spend ourselves into prosperity over time. And instead, I believe that President Trump's original policies, which reduce taxes and regulations, are exactly the tonic we should pursue going forward in a new round of negotiations. Okay. The CBO is saying you're going to get a snapback in the second half. A lot of private surveys say the same thing. We want to see a big bang 2021, too. And I'm a believer in the incentive model of growth. So let's say that the president's idea on the payroll tax, that would give the workforce who comes back to work a 7.5% increase in wages, after-tax wages, what Reagan used to call take-home pay. That's an incentive.
Larry Kudlow is director of the National Economic Council with reporters in the White House driveway. As votes are happening in the House, they have been taking a longer time than usual, and that's because the coronavirus-dictated social distancing guidelines has led to voting in waves, a few dozen members on the floor at any one time at the most. But today, the House also moved to make a change in its rules to allow remote proxy voting. An absent lawmaker could send a letter electronically to the House clerk to authorize another member to vote on his or her behalf and would provide exact instructions on how to vote on each question presented on the floor. Also, House committees could conduct hearings and deal with legislation remotely. Speaking in favor of this today, the Rules Committee Chair, Jim McGovern.
Think about the way we normally operate here. Members travel frequently from their home states, some of which are coronavirus hotspots, to convene together here in the Capitol complex. Then we travel back home at the end of the week, and we repeat this process month after month after month. Along the way, we come in contact with fellow travelers, colleagues, the general public, press, and hundreds of people who help make this house operate. There is no telling who among us, or who among them, could have compromised immune systems, pre-existing conditions, or other heightened risks for illness. But we know just how easy this virus spreads among those with strong immune systems. That is why the choices that each one of us makes are especially important. Not just about protecting members of Congress, this is about protecting all of those who come in contact with us. Now, any of us could have the virus and not even know it. We could be asymptomatic, but carriers nonetheless. Convening Congress must not turn into a super spreader event. Technology has changed considerably over the last 231 years. There are now tools available that make temporary committee proceedings and remote voting on the House floor possible. Not forever, just temporarily during this emergency.
Congressman Jim McGovern, Democrat, chair of the Rules Committee. Arguing against these changes, the Rules Committee ranking Republican Tom Cole.
Today, Mr. Speaker, the majority is proposing, for the first time in our history, a system of proxy voting on the floor of the House of Representatives. That change also allows for the adoption of a totally remote voting procedure upon the certification of a single member of Congress. Second, it would allow for committees to perform remote proceedings, including markups. Above all else, Mr. Speaker, Republicans believe that any change to centuries-old rules of the House should only be done in a bipartisan way that achieves consensus. Unfortunately, these proposed rule changes do not meet that goal. While I have no doubt of the chairman's good intentions, I believe these changes will fundamentally alter the nature of the institution and not for the better. And as such, I simply cannot support them. Though this resolution is intended only to deal with the present public health emergency, we must never forget that the temporary changes that we make today become the precedent that we follow tomorrow. I'm deeply concerned that shifting to remote activity, both in the form of proxy voting and the form of remote committee work, will fundamentally change the way the House operates and will remove the collegial environment we enjoy when we meet in person, get to know one another, and use our knowledge of each legislator as a person to move toward bipartisan consensus. I fear that that would be lost in remote activity. I'm also deeply concerned that these changes will not pass constitutional muster. Why would we risk exposing important legislation to obvious constitutional flaws does not make sense to me. Most of all, I'm concerned that we're moving forward with these changes on a partisan basis. Any change that is this consequential should only be done after we reach bipartisan agreement, no matter how difficult it may be to achieve.
Republican Congressman Tom Cole on the House floor. And joining us now with more on this House proxy voting proposal is Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Ornstein, you've been watching Congress for a while. How big of a change is this?
This is a significant change, but it's not as enormous as some of the members on the floor have suggested. In this sense, it's an emergency temporary measure that expires at the end of this Congress and that will only be invoked by the Speaker if, in fact, we're in the middle of a kind of pandemic demand that means that members simply can't get back to Washington, either because the transportation won't allow it or because the House physician, the Capitol physician, says, as he did just a week or so ago, that it would be extremely dangerous for members to travel back. So it's limited in time and frame, but at the same time, we have to take into account that changing to any form of remote activity in Congress is different than anything that we've seen before, and something that we had talked about back in the aftermath of 9/11, but never dealt with before now.
Republicans have raised the issue about whether this is constitutional or not. What's your take?
I believe it's clearly constitutional. I understand the reasoning behind the unease. It's kind of ironic in some ways because when I had worked with the Continuity of Government Commission in the aftermath of 9/11, and we wanted to move in a much more sweeping direction to get the approval, which would require a constitutional amendment, to have emergency interim appointments for widespread death and incapacitation in Congress. It was resisted by Republicans who then responded to the public pressure to do something by passing a rules change that was discussed in the Rules Committee yesterday and on the floor that would basically enable as few as two members of Congress to constitute a quorum and operate. Now, the Constitution says flatly that you need a majority of members to do official business. But, of course, the Constitution doesn't say that that majority has to be physically present. It just has to be present. And a virtual presence, it seems to me, given the circumstances and the changes in technology, will pass constitutional muster.
Even if this is a temporary change, how would Congress's interaction, the members' interaction, change with this proxy voting?
This is not something that we want to be a regular feature of Congress. And that's why, for some time, Speaker Pelosi was hesitant to move in this direction. Congress is supposed to be a place where people gather face-to-face to debate and deliberate. But I would use the same argument that I used with then Rules Committee Chairman David Dreyer back after 2001, which is we're not talking about the difference between a Congress the way we want it to be or a Congress that has some changes in it. Back then it was whether you could have temporary appointments where nobody had ever been a member of the House without being elected. It's a question of whether you have any Congress at all or one that has made provisions to be able to meet under emergency circumstances. So the main elements here, besides working through the technical issues and the security issues, is making sure that you set a very high threshold for implementing any of these changes and that they are definitely temporary. Now, I want to note that while this has turned into a starkly partisan matter in the House, it wasn't that way before we moved towards a vote. The problem-solving caucus with more than four dozen members, bipartisan, actually held a remote debating session to show that it could be done. In the Senate, the prime mover behind trying to get a remote capacity for voting in the Senate is Rob Portman, one of the most significant and distinguished Republicans in the Senate, working together with Democrat Dick Durbin, and it has bipartisan support. So this is not inherently a partisan issue. What Durbin and Portman did, and what Jim McGovern, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, did, working with Zoe Lofgren, the chair of House Administration, and the Democratic leader Steny Hoyer, is to make sure that you would set a threshold that it would be temporary, that it couldn't be made into a regular process. Without those safeguards, I wouldn't be supportive of this either.
Norm Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The coronavirus death toll in the U.S. now over 87,000. Experts say the country cannot truly return to something like it was before without a coronavirus vaccine. President Trump in the White House Rose Garden today announcing a former pharmaceutical executive and an Army general will lead his administration's effort to develop that. The project is called Operation Warp Speed.
We have the mightiest military in the long history of humankind. We have the best and most devoted workers ever to walk the face of the earth. And now we're combining all of these amazing strengths for the most aggressive vaccine project in history. There's never been a vaccine project anywhere in history like this. And I just want to make something clear. It's very important. Vaccine or no vaccine, we're back. And we're starting the process. And in many cases, they don't have vaccines, and a virus or a flu comes, and you fight through it. We haven't seen anything like this in 100-some-odd years, 1917. But you fight through it, and people sometimes, I guess, we don't know exactly yet, but it looks like they become immune, or at least for a short while, and maybe for life. But you fight through it. But what we'd like to do, if we can, is the vaccine. I think we're going to be successful in doing it, and hopefully by the end of the year.
President Donald Trump in the White House Rose Garden. The ousted former head of the federal government's vaccine effort, Rick Bright, told Congress this week that producing a vaccine in 12 to 18 months would be an aggressive schedule and that it will likely take longer. President Trump today asked why he believed the time frame could be shorter.
We've heard that the vaccine typically would take 12 to 18 months to develop. How can you do it in a speedier fashion? What makes you think this will work?
Well, they started actually, I guess you heard, in January, early January, and they've been working on it. I know so many, and private companies have been working on it. The government's been working on it. So we've got the time because we put and they've literally been working 24 hours a day. So we've got the time, and we hope to be able to do something by the end of the year or shortly thereafter. But again, you know, it's not solely vaccine-based. Other things have never had a vaccine, and they go away. So I don't want people to think that this is all dependent on vaccine, but a vaccine would be a tremendous thing. And I will tell you, therapeutically or therapeutics, what's going on there is equally as impressive. We have some things happening. You know, we have the remdesivir from Gilead. We have other things that are very good. I think that a lot is happening therapeutically. I can't say that it's, relatively speaking, equal to what's going on with vaccines, but I think it's doing very well, very well. So therapeutics are a big factor.
President Donald Trump at the White House. You can hear truck horns in the background. They were protesting for about a half hour, and the president had something to say about why.
And you hear that outside, that beautiful sound. Those are truckers that are with us all the way. They're protesting in favor of President Trump as opposed to against. There's hundreds of trucks out there. And that's the sign of love, not the sign of your typical protest. So I want to thank our great truckers. They like me and I like them. We're working on something together.
The Washington Post reports the truckers are protesting low shipping rates imposed by freight brokers, drivers saying that's making it difficult to make a living wage. The president and Congress have not provided so far targeted relief for the trucking industry. Parts of New York, the state hardest hit by the coronavirus, beginning to reopen. Governor Andrew Cuomo at his regular news conference in Albany talking about smaller cities and rural areas of upstate restarting construction, manufacturing, and curbside retail pickup.
The Regional Control Center will have a daily morning meeting where they review and monitor the infection testing and hospitalization rates. And I can't stress this enough. We're starting to turn the valve. One of my favorite graphics, not saying a heck of a lot, starting to turn the activity valve. Watch what happens to the infection rate, testing rate, hospitalization rate. If those numbers start to move, slow down on the activity level. That requires you to monitor the impact of this increase in public activity. You will see an increase. We expect to see an increase. But that increase has to be monitored and has to be controlled. We've talked about the infection rate, the rate of transmission. When the rate of transmission hits 1.1, you're headed towards a bad place. So monitor that rate daily and correct immediately if you see an increase in those numbers.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Rapid widespread testing is considered essential to tracking and containing the coronavirus. But according to an AP analysis of metrics developed by Harvard's Global Health Institute, 41 of the nation's 50 states failed to test widely enough to drive their infection rate below the key benchmark. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 60, NASDAQ up 70, and S&P up 11. Commerce Department says U.S. retail sales fell by a record 16.4% from March to April as the coronavirus kept shoppers away. The managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, said this week the fund was very likely to revise downward its forecast that global output would shrink by 3% in 2020. She spoke today at an event hosted by Politico.
It wasn't that long ago in January, we were in Davos, we were presenting our projections. We were talking about anemic growth, and it was in the order of around 3%. Only weeks afterwards, from having 160 countries with positive growth, we found ourselves in a situation of 170 countries with negative growth, and we had to drop our growth projections by over 6%. We are in minus territory. Incoming data tells us that it is likely for some economies to be in an even more adverse scenario than we projected just 4 weeks ago during our spring meetings. So to answer your question, in terms of the most severe shock, it has already occurred. What we are likely to see in the future is not as dramatic impact on employment and economic activities, but possibly some further shrinking vis-a-vis what we projected. We do expect a rebound, a recovery. But for 2021, even in the best case scenario, it would be only a partial recovery. In other words, we will be in 2022, 2023, when we see the 2019 situation returning.
Wow, that's four lost years. That is sobering.
It is going to be a time for the world to come together and go through this crisis, we will be on the other side. And the more we cooperate, the better the outcomes will be.
International Monetary Fund Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva. Over 300 lawmakers from around the world urging the IMF and World Bank to cancel the debt of the poorest countries in response to the pandemic. The effort in the U.S. being led by Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. The World Health Organization saying doctors and world leaders need to be on the alert for cases of a rare inflammatory disease in children that may be linked to the coronavirus. Here is Director General of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, in Geneva.
This evening, WHO will release a scientific brief on multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. In the past weeks, reports from Europe and North America have described a small number of children being admitted to intensive care units with a multisystem inflammatory condition with some features similar to Kawasaki's disease and toxic shock syndrome. Initial reports hypothesize that this syndrome may be related to COVID-19. It's critical to urgently and carefully characterize this clinical syndrome to understand causality and to describe treatment interventions. Together with our global clinical network for COVID-19, WHO has developed a preliminary case definition and a case report form for multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. I call on all clinicians worldwide to work with your national authorities and WHO to be on the alert and better understand this syndrome in children. I will repeat this. I call on all clinicians worldwide to work with your national authorities and WHO to be on the alert and better understand this syndrome in children. I thank you.
WHO Director General at a news conference in Geneva, Switzerland. Cases of this disease in children have been found in 17 U.S. states and 6 European countries. This has been Washington Today. Thanks for being with us. Be sure to download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen to C-SPAN Radio anywhere and get our podcasts. And you can also find our podcasts at cspan.org/podcasts. Have a good night and weekend, and stay safe.